You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 6, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, bigger than expected win for Bernie Sanders in Wisconsin as New York polls, not the actual polls, but the polling on the polls, close in New York. And on the Republican side, Ted Cruz almost guarantees that we're going to see quite the bloodbath in Cleveland. And the Republicans know what they're doing when it comes to voter ID. Huge lines and disenfranchisement last night in Wisconsin. And a Republican congressman gives it up. Meanwhile, that Sanders New York Daily News interview is not an example of a bad interview, but how good policy gets a hatchet job. And one thing clear from Wisconsin last night, and frankly, New York and California, liberals are ascendant. And we will talk about why that's the case and what that has to do with the fall. Donald Trump paying people to like him.
And doing a tremendous job.
And the Planned Parenthood sting, remember that? It turns out it's going to end up biting the stingers in the buttocks.
And not even getting Fiorina more than 2% of the vote.
Yeah, they did manage to get Planned Parenthood defunded in half a dozen states across the country. But hopefully they've been able to make that up in fundraising. All right, let's get to this stuff. Before we do, though, I just want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, you'll note at the beginning of this program, I say the four-time award-winning Majority Report. And that is because for 4 years running, it's really a sort of odd. They sort of screwed up the awards last year, and we won the 2015. There is no 2014 award winner as far as I know. But we won 2011, 12, 13, and 15, and no one won 14. So it's really five-year running. Four-time award-winning best news in politics from podcastawards.com. Well, ladies and gentlemen, they are the news in politics is live. The Podcast Awards nominations are live. If you go to podcastawards.com, right now, you can nominate the Majority Report. What you do is you scroll down to News and Politics, and let's see, how do you do here? It's not quite clear. I think maybe what you do is we're already there, but I don't know. We got to get more It's not quite clear, is it?
I have no idea.
I'm there right now.
Same. Does anybody else
understand this? Oh, listeners apply here. Wait a second. We need 20 listeners and podcasters. No? I'm not quite sure how it works, to be honest with you. But soon, and I guess we're nominated.
We're a machine.
Oh, listener nominations open the 15th. I see. Ah. So we're not even there yet. I just wanted to give you a heads up for that. And I feel like I've done it. All right, let's dig into the what's going on in what happened in Wisconsin last night. Bernie Sanders won 56% to 43%. He significantly outperformed the Real Call Clear Politics. I mean, all of the aggregate polling had him like winning, I don't know, anywhere from like 2.5 to 5%.
Just want to say credit where credit is due. Matt was the closest.
Yeah, but I mean, that was really, what do you call it? The rules.
Spitballing.
No, what was it? Price is
Nonsense.
Right.
Price is right. Guess
because he won by 13%. Now, he picked up 11 more delegates, and that's sort of the challenge that Bernie Sanders has. Is that because the delegate awards are proportional and more proportional in the Democratic race, just generally speaking, than in the Republican one, he needs to open up a bigger lead in these situations. Polling doesn't have him ahead in New York State, but it has been closing for weeks. There's going to be a debate next Thursday in Brooklyn.
What?
We may actually cover it. I think this might be, I mean, it would be almost ridiculous if we didn't.
I will put on a Mao uniform to express my support for Bernie.
Well, there you go.
Or for the Clinton campaign, as it were, if I actually did that.
On the Republican side, it appears that John Kasich's support in Wisconsin collapsed over the last couple of weeks. Ted Cruz wins big, 48% to 35%. He takes 36 delegates to Trump's 6 to Kasich's zeros. Now, what this is going to mean, and it's not, look, it's not, it's unclear, obviously. This is not, nobody has a crystal ball. But unless some dynamic changes fairly significantly, and California is really, it looks like, the big question in the Republican race, it appears that Donald Trump is going to get anywhere from 1150 delegates to 1236 delegates. And that is going to be one delegate shy of clinching the nomination. You need a majority of delegates to clinch the nomination. Otherwise, if you don't get those delegates, they vote once, then all of those pledged delegates can vote the way that they want. The theory being, and these are the rules at the beginning of the race, the theory being that what if there was a very fractured field and one guy couldn't get the majority of delegates, but all the other candidates combined would rather coalesce around a different candidate who the Republican Party wants to be their nominee. Now, that's the reality. They could change the Rule 40, which would allow somebody other than Ted Cruz, who's going to be the only person showing up at the convention, who would be eligible to run in that second balloting and subsequent third or fourth if necessary. If they don't change the rule, it's either going to be Ted Cruz or Donald Trump. If they change the rule, it could be anybody nominated on that second ballot. So it's unclear what will happen. It's really a function of who's going to be on that rules committee. Now, the rules committee theoretically could also say, hey, you know, this whole rule about the majority of delegates, nah, we're scrapping that. You need 2/3. delegates to win on the first round. Otherwise, it opens up again. Or they could say, you just need a plurality. So this could all change. But no matter how you slice it, it is going to be a disaster for the Republicans, in my opinion. And I'll tell you why I say that. And these things can change, of course. Here is what Trump voters, here's the percentage of Trump voters as to what they believe should happen if there is a candidate without a majority of delegates. In other words, if no one hits 1237, 83% of Trump voters believe that the candidate with most votes should be the nominee. So in other words, despite what the rules say, we think the guy who's ahead should get the nomination. 56% of Republican primary goers coming out of Wisconsin think that it should be the candidate with the most votes. Now, remember, Wisconsin is sort of like a moderate state insofar as, like, they don't like procedural hijinks. That was the big issue when it came to recalling Scott Walker. So if 83% of Wisconsin voters, or Trump voters, I should say, there feel that way, you know that the numbers may even be higher of other Trump voters. And there's a lot more of them than there were in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, 35% were Trump voters. But in New York, you're going to see that number closer to 50% or more. Cruz and Kasich voters, of course, say 41%. 41% of them say that the highest vote getter. So it's enough to be in that area where a lot of people are going to feel like there's something wrong if Donald Trump comes in with 1150 or 1200 or 1210 and he's not the nominee. Even Cruz and Kasich voters, 40% of them. So you understand what we're building here. This is a very volatile situation.
I think it's fantastic, frankly.
And then you can see the opposite numbers. 58% of Cruz and Kasich voters say that if no candidate wins a majority of delegates, 1237, the delegates can just open it up and decide. 58% of Cruz and Kasich voters say that. 14% of Trump voters say that. 42% of all Republican voters. So this is really, this is like, I don't know. I mean, I've read that if you mix regular dishwashing liquid that you do by hand with the automatic dishwashing liquid, there's some like horrible chemical reaction. I don't know if that is just a myth, but I've been very, very conscious of that, particularly since we had kids. I don't know why. But as bad as that might be, or is the fiction, this is going to be worse. This is, I mean, a recipe. Now, here is why I think the Republican Party now realizes they're facing a disaster, or they can choose to face a catastrophe. Who would you vote for in November if it was Cruz? Oh, excuse me. Of all Republican voters are asked, who would you vote for in November if it was Trump versus Clinton? 61% of Republican primary goers said that they would vote for Trump if it was Trump versus Clinton. Only 6 out of 10 primary goers in Wisconsin would vote for Trump. 20% said they would vote for a third party. 10% said they would vote for Clinton. And almost 10% said they would not vote. However, if Ted Cruz is the nominee, then about 60% would vote for Ted Cruz. 20% would vote for a third party. 10% would vote for Clinton. And 10% wouldn't vote. So in other words, a catastrophe or a disaster. And the reason why, if you were a Republican establishment member, you would want Ted Cruz as opposed to Donald Trump, as much as you loathe Ted Cruz, really loathe him, both sort of politically and personally, it's because he's already come to you and said, look, we can work together, A, and B, you're keeping the apparatus in-house. With Donald Trump, the apparatus, you lose control totally of the apparatus. With Ted Cruz, you're going to have to, you know, do a little of this and you're going to have to. But once he loses, the apparatus will revert right back to you. I mean, Donald Trump, even having the apparatus for 3 months, I think would be scary to them.
What's happening with the apparatus? Mm. Who knows? I mean, look.
You want it back?
Anything could happen. I mean,
sorry.
The apparatus got broke, but I think it's better.
That's right.
Than it was. I mean, did a great job with the apparatus.
Remember, the Republican Party is already sort of losing to the Koch brothers in terms of institutional party apparatus. The Koch brothers have three times the amount of people working. They have a better voter data file, apparently, than the Republican Party. So this is what the establishment is terrified about. And this is why I can get up every morning. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. But I got to say, the amount of joy I'm getting from this is really...
Just imagine your kids listening to this before they head to therapy 20 years from now. The day before my recital that my dad said he gets up in the morning because of a horrible man that ran for president a couple of decades ago.
My kids...
Thanks.
My kids get what I just said over the past 10, 15 minutes.
In real time.
No, every day. We right. wake up. I just do the story in smaller increments because they have a less of an attention span.
I acted out
for them, too.
I could picture you holding Saul as a baby, or Myler for that matter, and kind of like gazing at them lovingly and being like, I hate you. You ruined my life. I get no sleep because of you. Daddy hates you so much. Thank God a mean man is running for president and Daddy has some amusement because he's tired because of you.
My sister, I think it was, said something to Myla about a mortgage. And my sister was like, a mortgage is... And Myla was like, I know what a mortgage is. My dad does a political talk show.
She was kidding about the political talk show. It was a joke.
What do you mean?
Sister said it was a joke. She was like, do you know that my dad does a political talk?
Well, yeah, I know. Myla was mocking my sister, but she also knows
right,
what a mortgage
is. I was trying
is.
To make her sound a little less snotty. Like,
oh, Myla, good luck.
She sounds like
I'm not
you.
Sure she would appreciate that. She doesn't. She's... All right. So that's the situation on the right. I should also add, and this is important, in light of the Wisconsin election, there's a lot of people who say that, in a sheer number, 35%, Donald Trump, that's basically been where he's been, right, throughout this. One-third of the Republican Party supporting him. 35%, longtime listeners will know, that's a number that I used to talk about 6 or 7 years ago, because 35% is almost exactly the... approval rating for George Bush when he left office.
I just really think he's doing a great job.
And but 35% is, I think, is nationally. So you got to add Trump and Cruz together, and there you go.
All right.
But in response to the loss in Wisconsin and heading into the Northeast, where Trump really wants to crush it in New York, and Rhode Island, and Pennsylvania, Connecticut. It was announced yesterday that by Trump campaign manager, and I don't know if he does this from, he doesn't, it was a misdemeanor assault, right? So he wouldn't do this from a jail cell. Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski, well, he hasn't been convicted. He's only been charged. sometimes they hold people if they think they're a flight risk. But I
Dude, I'm not going anywhere.
Right.
I'm working on the campaign.
Corey Lewandowski said in an interview on yesterday, Tuesday, that a memo published by the Washington Post detailing how Trump plans to get to Mexico to pay for his proposed border wall is a prelude to a series of moves that flesh out the policies that Trump has been speaking out in general terms in his rallies. In other words, Donald Trump is planning a series of policy speeches.
Time to get detailed. I've said tremendous before. I've said fantastic, and I've said great. Have I said it all in the same speech? Yes, but not in this particular order.
So that's going to be fun.
Here's what we're going to do. I have a 10-point tremendous plan.
Be tremendous. Be great.
It
Win.
Starts with a strategy of winning.
And no, I'm sure they're going to be able to hire somebody to... they're going to be able to hire somebody to write that speech, to write those speeches. For
Objectives,
them.
I mean, great. Strategy, deals. Tactics, win. It's true.
What's going to be interesting is going to be seeing if he needs a teleprompter, right? Because wasn't that the big issue for, I don't know. That's going to be, I think, pretty interesting to see if he needs that teleprompter. Before we move on to the Democrats, I should also say this is a funny story, and this is an appropriate time to provide this. From Inside Business, what is it? Business Insider. Donald Trump has 1.7 million followers on Facebook. Of those 1.7 million followers on Facebook, only 42% are American. That seems a little odd that only less than half of Trump's followers would be American. But of course, Donald Trump's name is so popular in places like Dubai and Japan,
Colombia.
Other places where he has property. However, the remaining 58% don't come from any of those places, or very few. In fact, most of them come from places like the Philippines, Malaysia, India, Indonesia, and Colombia. This is according to a Vocative analysis. These locations just coincidentally have been deemed hubs for Facebook fraud, specifically their home to Like Farms. Oh, one in every 27 Trump followers is from the Philippines. People like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz also have followers there. Only one in 519 Cruz followers and one in 573 Rubio followers from the South Asian country of the Philippines. Trump's Malaysian followers, this is odd too, revealed that some of them like more than 7,000 pages each. What do these people in Malaysia do? They just sit around and everybody's just on Facebook all the time. That must be during the rainy season. And it includes
monsoon humor on the Majority Report.
Pages
well done.
Created for brands, celebrities, and TV shows. Many accounts have nothing in common with another. If they like things that contradict each other, it may be another indication that the profile is fake, according to an expert at Vocative. There are pages like Boost Likes and others, apparently, that get you 300 to 400 fans a month, and then there's other, you know, larger sites. But you'll recall there was also a story and claims by people in attendance who were there wearing Trump shirts that when Donald Trump descended from that golden escalator and spoke in front of wild supporters, many claimed to be paid extras, getting their $50 a day to sit in the audience. So I don't know.
All right. Now, all that said, obviously he's majorly fraudulent, but please, this is a general call. If there are any Malaysian Donald Trump supporters that are real, could you please call this program?
Indeed.
Please.
And just coincidentally, we share a ton of those people in Malaysia as followers.
I was always so surprised why they would like us and Donald Trump.
Very strange. Yeah. Very, very strange.
Us, Donald Trump, and Jimmy Choo's.
All right. I want to get back to the Democratic race because there was some really interesting exit polling that came out of the Democratic race, which probably shouldn't be a surprise, but it goes towards the issue of a broader movement that Bernie Sanders is not necessarily leading, in my estimation, but is a Bernie Sanders' success is a manifestation of something that is happening within and to a certain degree without the Democratic Party. In 2008, the share of Wisconsin primary voters, you'll recall that was a very contested election. The share of Democratic voters calling themselves moderate or conservative was 53%. 47% rated themselves liberal. This year, nearly 66% of voters in Wisconsin say they're liberals. One quarter of whom say they're very liberal. That is up 20 points in terms of liberal, 10 points in terms of very liberal. This is I think it's a big deal. And this is indicative of what's happening, I think, across the country. In 2000, Democrats identified themselves 23% conservative, 45% moderate, 27% liberal. In 2015, according to the Pew Research Center, only 17% identified themselves as conservative, 38% as moderate, and 42% liberal. This is the first time in 15 years, at least, when Democratic voters self-identified themselves more often as liberal than either moderate or conservative. And, I mean, it speaks to, in my estimation, I mean, this is a 9-point bump since 2008. It speaks to, I think, a bunch of different factors. But it certainly puts holes in the argument that having a Democrat in the presidency hurts this movement. Now, it's hard to know what people mean when they describe themselves as liberal or moderate or conservative. But certainly, that word in the late 90s, the 80s, and in the Bush administration, the word liberal was toxic even for liberals, even for people who would hold that issue set. I don't know what you can glean from that, but certainly stating what your positions are and not being embarrassed or cowed by them, I think is important to getting them enacted. And look what we've just seen in the past, I don't know, 2 or 3 years in New York State. Zephyr Teachout runs in New York State against Governor Cuomo. She does not win. She takes what, about maybe 25, 30% of the vote in the Democratic primary. But Andrew Cuomo, who had no inclination for a $15 minimum wage, I can assure you, before that election, no inclination for the most generous paid leave program in the nation, signed that bill the other day. In California, Jerry Brown passes a, signs also a $15 minimum wage. 2 or 3 years ago, when we were talking about these sort of wildcat strikes from fast food workers across the country, the idea that we would see $15 minimum wage in the two biggest states in the country was completely far-fetched by all accounts. There's momentum here. There's significant momentum. And standing right next to Andrew Cuomo, and I can assure you it's annoying for a lot of people, was Hillary Clinton, who advocates a national $12 minimum wage. To be fair, says she thought it would be appropriate $15 in some states. But the point is, though, this is what you want, even if you don't like the politician. This is what you want, because at the end of the day, it is not about the politician. I mean, this sounds cliche. It is about the people who support them. Here's a case in point. When the Obama administration was contemplating nominating Merrick Garland, part of the reason why they did so was because they thought more reasonable heads in the Republican Party would prevail. Well, that's what they did. Or would at least it would put pressure on them. And you've got people like Chuck Grassley, who I think had said earlier, right? Didn't Chuck Grassley said that Garland would have been okay? Was that Hatch?
No, it was Hatch.
Chuck Grassley, supposedly, you know, a responsible member of the Judiciary Committee. Grassley had praised Garland in the past because of his work as a prosecutor. Here is Chuck Grassley on the Senate floor on Tuesday, and listen to what he's doing. Listen to who he's attacking. And understand that it's not a function of Chuck Grassley. It's a function of who the Republican Party, who the electoral base of the Republican Party is. And this is the power that these lunatics in the Republican Party have achieved. You don't necessarily have to be a lunatic to achieve power in a political party. It just so happens that they are lunatics in the Republican Party. And here's who Chuck Grassley was attacking on the Senate floor on Tuesday. Was it Barack Obama? Was it Merrick Garland? Was it, Rachel Maddow? I mean, who could Chuck Grassley been attacking?
Exactly backwards. The confirmation process doesn't make the justices appear political. The confirmation process has gotten political precisely because the court itself has drifted from the constitutional text and rendered decisions based instead on policy preferences. In short, the justices themselves have gotten political. And because the justices' decisions are often political and transgress their constitutional role, the process becomes more political. In fact, many of my constituents believe, with all due respect, that the Chief Justice is part of this problem. They believe that the number of his votes have reflected political considerations, not legal ones.
They're calling John Roberts the umpire, right? Balls and strikes. His constituents are forcing him to get on the Senate floor and say that John Roberts is playing too loose and fast with the Constitution and is just interested in promoting liberal policies. That's the dynamic that if you want to understand what politics are about, that's what politics are about. That's what politics are about. So at the end of the day, the problem with Donald Trump is, although he's, I think, also severely unbalanced, is the people who would vote for him. And he is going to be pushed by the people who voted for him. And a Democrat, whether it's Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, is going to be pushed by the people who vote for them. Now, it may be harder to push them in certain ways and in certain directions, but it's extremely unlikely, and it just simply doesn't happen, that liberals are going to be able to push a Republican president anywhere. Anywhere. It's just not going to happen. And that's the dynamic that people have to understand.
Just to amplify what you're saying, I would actually say Andrew Cuomo is a great example. If anything, I would say he's to the right of Hillary Clinton. He is someone who could make Hillary Clinton look, certainly relatively speaking, progressive. And I also think another example of this, and I know it didn't, the first time they went at him, it didn't work out and he won re-election. But, you know, eventually Joe Lieberman was a guy who went against his party and his constituency so much that he essentially got himself out of politics. I mean, he got away with it once against Ned Lamont, basically by actually totally minimizing Iraq and pretending, as far as I understood, that he was like a loyal Democrat, except that.
Everything but the war.
Everything but the war, and progressive except the war. And then he spent the next 6 years being, you know, the disgusting person that he is, to the point that if he had attempted to run a re-election in Connecticut, I'm quite sure he would have lost a primary and a general in a blowout.
All right, so let's, that's the important dynamic to keep in mind. Now, with that said, and I want to get to Evan Well a little bit, and this voter ID. I mean, let's not go too deep into the voter ID. I mean, I think everybody was aware in Wisconsin, the lines were hours and hours long. Many people did not vote because of how long it was. They were waiting because of this new voter ID requirement, because the state has done nothing to inform their voters on the details of it. You had voting officials who didn't know what constituted a valid document to vote with. Student IDs, for some reason, even though this is about stopping voter fraud or undocumented immigrants, as our right-wing caller Doug would say, student IDs were not considered valid. People who have to pay to get something fixed on their birth certificate, $200, who couldn't afford to, they were shut out of voting. Nobody's quite sure how many people are going to be shut out, but it could be up to 300,000. Why would you do this, right? Why would you do this if you really cared about democracy? I guess the answer has to be something like, we're afraid of widespread of fraud. And the one thing that we're going to get out of this, it's not about helping one party or another. It's just about making sure that our election is fair. Right? That's the answer. We just want to be able to have faith in our election, even if people get turned away at the voting booths. Well, I think that's uncontroversial. But let's just check in with Glenn Grothman. He is a Republican, a congressman from Wisconsin. What does he think this is going to bring about?
Take me forward to November. You know that a lot of Republicans since 1984 in the presidential races have not been able to win in Wisconsin. Why would it be any different for Ted Cruz or a Donald Trump?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton is about the weakest candidate the Democrats have ever put up. And now we have photo ID, and I think photo ID is going to make a little bit of a difference as well.
But if Ted Cruz is the guy, what will his message be to try to win in Wisconsin if he's up against Hillary Clinton? Or can you imagine a scenario that he's up against Bernie Sanders?
I think either way, it's the same message he used to win the primaries. You know, welfare, government spending, and immigration.
All right. Congressman Grothman, we really appreciate
We really appreciate it. And sorry for not following up on that time, that moment when you said photo ID is really going to help us. So either the representative has evidence or even a theory that there were tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Democratic votes that were fraudulent in the past elections, right? I mean, that's quite a bombshell to sit on. I've never released it, but I do have this theory that there were hundreds of thousands of fraudulent votes. That's why the Democrats keep winning in Wisconsin. Or he just never believed that and thinks that there's going to be enough people disenfranchised who are Democrats that the Republicans are going to have a chance. I mean, is there any other explanation? Let me answer that for you. No. No.
He knows.
And kudos to that reporter for zeroing in on that.
Oh, okay, you just admitted that your main domestic policy initiative is about disenfranchising voters for the opposing party. Great.
Sweet.
Any other thoughts, Congressman?
But, dude.
By the way, how are the new digs in Congress? Nice bump up.
How much do you think on his Twitter bio too? That reporter is going to put like, "I'm the guy who got Grothman to admit that voter ID was all about electing Republicans."
That would actually be a funny character, a reporter that gets like the guy who like gets OJ to admit he did it, but is the only person in the world who never registers what happened. It's like, "Yeah, I did. I killed them." All right, great. So I hear your golf game is going okay, even though your back is sore.
Right, exactly.
But you need to use the reporter because...
Going to a signing soon? You're going to a signing.
I like
that. That's just unbelievable to me. All right, I got one more story I want to talk about. I know... and then we've got some more fun clips. Fun sound clips for you in the fun half. But this is, there was this explosion about this interview that Bernie Sanders gave the New York Daily News. You know, they give these editorial board news things. And literally, I mean, I didn't have a chance to read it yesterday. Jonathan Capehart. 9 things Bernie Sanders should have known about but didn't in that Daily News interview. The Daily News is a disaster. I know where his...
Banking expert, Jonathan Capehart.
Right. But if you just Google New York Daily News Bernie interview, just doing this, I don't know. It comes up with like Sanders feeling media heat after new interview. 9 things Bernie Sanders should have known. The New York Daily Bernie Sanders interview is, let's see, what is it saying? Was pretty close to a disaster. This New York Daily News is, let's see, What else?
Bernie got schlonged.
Yeah,
the New York
I mean, it
Times.
Goes on. No, did Bernie kidding. Sanders botch an interview? He takes heat for Daily News. Hit hard for Daily News thing. Bernie Sanders fails disaster interview with New York Daily News. I mean, it goes on and on. I read the interview, and the only thing that I found was even problematic was the position that he's continued to hold in terms of gun manufacturers' liability. And I think that's been a pretty clear and I think well-known controversial issue that he holds. But the rest of it is not just not a disaster, but seems to be completely accurate. I mean, the facile way of saying this is the headline should be Bernie Sanders doesn't explain positions he holds as well as Hillary Clinton explains positions she doesn't hold in terms of holding the banks accountable. But the fact is, he did a perfectly legitimate and more than legitimate. It's the Daily News that doesn't seem to know what they're talking about, or those people who got the message, we're going to hit Bernie Sanders on this to make that argument that he's not practical, it's all pie in the sky. Mike Konzel, who is by no means has been pretty critical of Bernie Sanders on a lot of things. I mean, he's not the only one who also put this out. I mean, Zach Carter had a similar from Huffington Post.
Ryan Grimm, I think, has a new thing up as well.
Yeah. The issues that people seem to be talking about are breaking up the big banks. And Bernie Sanders apparently supposedly doesn't know. They were laughing at Bernie Sanders' plan to pass to break up the big banks. And according to Konzel, there's really three ways that we can break up the banks. One is statutorily, put some sort of cap on the size of a balance sheet of a financial company. Sherrod Brown has an example of that, the Safe Banking Act, generally proposed to be about 2 or 3% of GDP. Have the Council of Regulators, known as the Financial Stability Oversight Council, chaired by the Treasury Secretary, declare the largest firms to be too risky and must be broken up. That's Section 121 of Dodd-Frank. The first one would also work via Dodd-Frank. And the third is have the Federal Reserve, along with the FDIC, determine that the living wills of the biggest banks are not credible and thus must be broken up by Section 165D. I'm sorry, the first would work through Congress. The last two would be Dodd-Frank. So in other words, there's three different ways in which you can break up the big banks. So when the Daily News says, do you think the Fed has that authority? And Sanders said, well, I don't know if the Fed has it, but the administration can have it. In other words, the Fed has to be pushed along with the FDIC and the Fed has to be pushed by the administration to make that determination about the living wills. Sanders apparently is more interested in the Section 121, which is having the Financial Stability Oversight Council declare that the largest firms are too risky and must be broken up. And the how in which you do this is, and this would probably work the same way for the first one, where you declare that statutory cap on how big they can be. You say to the banks, we have assessed your balance sheet. You're too big. We're going to give you 180 days, 60 days, 90 days, however many days, to come up with a plan which you must submit to us, to this board, to this regulatory agency that is empowered by this legislation, to tell us how you're going to get under that cap. How are you going to break up in such a way that you will not run afoul of this too big to fail edict, law, regulation, whatever it ends up being? And then the banks will pursue it in a way that is most profitable for them, but one in which puts them under this cap so they are not a systemic risk. So they're not a risk to the economy. That's the issue here. The issue isn't we're going to keep the banks from being too profitable in some specific way or another way. It's just we don't want the banks to control, any given bank, to control so much money or trading or leverage that it fundamentally makes our entire financial system unstable. That's the point here. So Daily knows, like, where would the investing go? Where would there be a consumer bank? Sanders says, I'm not running J.P. Morgan or Chase or Citibank. In other words, Sanders knows how this is going to go. We tell the bank, you need to get under this size. How you do it is your business. Just come back to us with what your plan is. We sign off. And the Daily knows, says, no, but you'd be breaking up the bank. Sanders says, that's right. And it's their decision as to what to do and how they want to do it. Reconfigure themselves. That's the right way to go about it, frankly, and it's also correct. But the New York Daily News and these morons are saying, like, he's going to let the banks break themselves up. Yeah. The issue isn't how they break up. The issue is whether or not they are forced to break up.
That's the story of so much of this campaign, though. It's always like, ha-ha, he doesn't get it.
Exactly.
Oh, wait.
I we don't actually, get it.
Yeah, I don't. So,
and then they ask no him about the MetLife court decision, which is where a judge, a Bush-appointed judge, determined that under the under Dodd-Frank, MetLife was not considered too big to fail and was not subject to certain requirements that would have been imposed upon it by that would have been imposed upon it by, I think it's the SEC. And they asked him, like, what about this decision? And Sanders said, well, that's something I have not studied, honestly, the legal implications of that. And there's a reason why he hasn't studied it. Is it because he's lazy? No, it's because still today the ruling is sealed. So we don't know what the opinion is.
That's no excuse.
So there's no way to
know. He doesn't know how to get things done.
And then the issue of criminal convictions. The idea, like, what would you have charged them with, these bankers? And he says, I don't know. I'm not a prosecutor. There was fraud there. I don't know the exact statute, is what they said. And they're like, can you believe it? He's all about prosecuting these bankers, and he doesn't know what the exact statute is. And I think Consul makes the issue, makes the point. Is there anybody who's listening to the sound of my voice who's not a prosecutor or law enforcement official who can tell me what the statute is that makes murder illegal?
In fairness, though, I think he was being a little coy because the charge will be being bourgeoisie counter-revolutionaries. And when we have show trials and Marxist courts,
in other words, you're
they'll
saying
they'll be summarily executed. Right. And I don't think
there's
he feels
no statute.
Comfortable.
There's yeah. no existing statute.
Yeah, we're not.
I mean, that's the point.
We're Marxist legal scholars here.
Everyone knows, most people should know, that the reason why that was given by the Justice Department and the USAs across the country, why they did not pursue, and attorney generals, why they did not pursue criminal charges against these bankers and Wall Street types was because there was a concern that they couldn't win and they didn't want to expend the resources there. And then there's also that time that Lanny Breuer said, well, they're too big to jail. We don't want to undermine and destroy a company where a lot of people would lose their jobs. Even putting that aside, the issue wasn't that prosecutors didn't know what statute to prosecute these people with. It was they were risk averse. And every administration enters in and basically says to the Justice Department, or the president appoints a attorney general who determines how risk averse they will be in certain areas. So a Bernie Sanders attorney general will be less risk averse in that area. That's the way this works. So you have the New York Daily News pretending they're adults. And then a bunch of hacks, frankly, pretending they're adults too. And that if Bernie Sanders says this thing, he should have more specifics. There are no more specifics. This is actually exactly what you would want from a president. Now, there's no way that Hillary Clinton could answer these questions with more specificity because she doesn't agree with the policy positions that Sanders has. She's just not going to be as aggressive with Wall Street. That's a fact. That's simply a fact. And you can say, well, I don't think we should be more aggressive with Wall Street. The financialization of our country and our economy is good, and these guys know what they're doing, and I mean, that's an argument that you can have. But the idea that he's not giving the specifics he should. No, he's giving exactly the specifics.
Very good understanding it. Read Tim Geithner's book. Tim Geithner is very transparent about this stuff. And he does support, you know, he voices support for Dodd-Frank. He certainly thinks that there needed to be some greater regulation of the financial markets. But fundamentally, he thinks that financial services and financial products are a major boon to the American economy, and they should not be tightly regulated and certainly not broken up.
You don't want to inhibit innovation.
You don't want to stifle innovation. Apparently, innovation is better for mortgages than, like, you know, filmmaking. But regardless, he outlines some of the debates inside the administration. If you want to understand where the Clinton perspective is coming from, in an intellectually honest way, read Tim Geithner's book.
God.
I'm sorry, I know.
Seriously?
That was really just disgusting of me to even point out.
Bernie bro.
Total Bernie bro.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to head into the fun half, ladies and gentlemen. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to have somebody, I'm not quite sure yet, who on the Panama Papers. Intriguing. A lot of intrigue. A lot of very wealthy people, pretty bummed out.
A lot of people getting stuff done.
Yeah, exactly.
In those papers.
All right. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Folks, just a reminder, this show relies on its members for 98.3% of its, this is according to a spreadsheet, of its revenue. How's that for specificity? I noticed Sam only went to the first decimal point. Interesting. So please, become a member today. As always, if you can't afford to and you want the fun half, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. But if you can afford to support the program, please, your support makes this show possible. It allows us to expand. I am very conscientious in the way that we do expand and always am looking for things that will be self-sustaining for the show. And that's why, you know, we did that one time a fundraiser to launch new shows like Two Dope Boys, and we've got a couple other in the works. But we're pretty responsible with the way we do this. We're not, we're pretty risk averse here. Let's put
Barbados next week, brah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
nice.
We're not, Barbados, you go at this time of year because you're guaranteed to something.
That's not what I'm saying.
We're not the Ben Carson campaign.
No.
We are like the absolute inverse.
When we take the cash and head to Tulum to party, man, we do not do it except for at the best weather season. Let's put it that way.
If Ben Carson ran this show, we would be like individually sold off to like China to pay off the debts that would have accumulated.
All right, coming up in the fun half, Rick Scott gets a tongue lashing. and not the good kind, at a Starbucks in Florida. I love that clip. Bill O'Reilly will talk about the white grievance behind Trump support, which, of course, is always a function of the black grievance industry.
In the 1940s, black people got a raw deal. Now they're treated great, and we're tired of it.
And Elizabeth Warren hands a former regulator his head on a platter. It's quite enjoyable. All that and more, folks, coming up. Remember, oh, don't forget, justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MRSPRING16 for 30% off in April. 30% off. 30. One third. That's an amazing deal. JustCoffee.coop, buy the Majority Report blend. You've always wanted to try it, folks. Now you get it 30% off. Now it's cheaper than the crap you buy around the corner or you have to drive to or whatever it is. You've got to check it out.
What was
free
the,
shipping.
What was the deuce counterpoint to that? That was amazing.
Why would I spend $9 on a pound of coffee when I can get a cup for only $3 at Dunkin' Donuts?
Deuce logic. Hashtag deuce logic.
Those guys are completely harassing me now.
No, those guys are after getting
Dinesh
aggressive.
D'Souza.
I know.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. The fun half. 646-257-3920 is number. 646-257-3920 is number. You can IM me. We'll be right back after this.